I think the most famous farmer in America is Joel Salatin. And Joel's my guest on this Farm to Table Talk. Joel is admired, respected, and emulated, but you can't say he's typical or average. For one thing, I think Joel has been featured in films and documentaries and books, and he's even written books. Joel, I think maybe a dozen or so books.
Ten
books, okay. So you're not typical in that way either. But I'm almost hesitant to start and have you describe your operation, because I think anybody listening to this has heard you be interviewed by Michael Pollan and by, you know, everybody, the who's who in the food movement. I want to start a little differently. Why do you think so many people are so interested in what you do, how you farm, and why you do it?
Well, I think it's the interest in something that works. Things that work intrigue people. There are so many things that don't work, and they're frustrating. I mean, much of life is dealing with things that don't work, whether it's a marriage or your kids or your job, your boss, whatever, the project you're working on, And so to actually be able to visit, see, handle, and just kind of embrace or understand something that works on so many levels, spiritual levels, ecological levels, economic, community, social, relational, to appreciate that there is something that actually works where there aren't losers and winners. It's a floating of the commons. And in a time of fear about running out of things, about destroying things, to realize that there's a way to feed ourselves and increase the commons and heal so many things is magnetic. I mean, it's magnetic.
So in addition to a farmer, I think part of this, all the contributions that you make, you also are a grandfather. You've mentioned you've got grandchildren now, too, and I have grandchildren as well. I think kind of comment about what that means to you to be able to have them be part of your this whole farming experience.
Well, sure. The ultimate succession is what do the kids do when they hit, 18, 19, 20? And, of course, Stephen Covey, in his iconic book, Seven Habits of Highly Effective People, talks about starting with the end in view. And a very personal story here. When my wife and I got married, we started having kids, and we said, well, what do we want the future to be like? And to Stephen Covey's idea of start with the end in view, I remember telling her, I want to someday be a grandfather where my grandchildren only argue about who gets to spend the day with grandpa. I would like a life like that. And so even before we had children, we had that dream, that goal. And so we raised our own children in that respect. And now today on the farm, we have four generations. My mother is still a very active 92-year-old and drives and dances and sings and all that. And then we have Therese and I, and then our son and daughter-in-law, and we have three grandchildren, 12, 10, and 8. And they do argue about who gets to spend with grandpa. And so, I think this long-range view and actually building your dream, and it's okay to build a dream, but then don't just build a dream. Make action steps. What am I going to have to live like, do like, be like for that dream to happen? And that's a really inspiring idea.
Well, one other word for grandpas here, I think, is that grandpas are bringing their grandkids out to see your farm. So you actually are also hosting other people that kind of vicariously are
yes,
kind of a weekend farmer, because they come out and see how you're doing it.
Well, sure. And the thing is, then our grandkids, here's the thing that you have to realize, because we direct marketed and had a beautiful farm that was what we say good farming should be, aesthetically and aromatically, sensually romantic, okay, mm-hmm, that as when our kids were growing up, all of their friends, when they would come and spend the night or a party or whatever, any kind of function, they thought that our farm was a cool place because there was always something neat to see, a turtle down by the pond, a clutch of, you know, whatever, wood duck eggs, you know, out by the pond, a new baby calf, a new set of chicks had arrived, a new spider web was in the garden, okay? It's a place of wonder, as opposed to so many farms where there's no wonderment to see. It's just rows of corn or a factory farm that who wants to go walk in the factory farm? I mean, the thing stinks. You want to get as far away from it as you can. And so to have a farm that was a place of joy, wonder, and awesomeness, our kids' friends, instead of looking down on them as farmers, they said, this is the coolest, awesomest, you know, place to live in. And it affirmed the respect, the honor of farming to our kids, as opposed to our kids being embarrassed about being farmers growing up. And now our grandkids are doing the same thing. Hey, let's go, you know, I want to show you this cool thing and that. And so there's this whole multi-generational wonderment that goes with it. And I think as we nest, if we can nest our farms into the ecology, into the ecological womb, if you will, so that we have more wildlife, we have more diversity, we have more forestal, open land, riparian intersections, it does make a mosaic that is interesting, and there's a mystery around every corner, and that's cool.
Well, explain to me how your farm is different than my grandfather's farm might have been. My family had been farming since the 1840s back in central Illinois, and I think they raised the livestock and all the feed that they grew, they put it through the farm and so forth. So in some ways, when people look at what you're doing with your farm, it seems kind of like farming was 50, 60 years ago. How do you see it different than that?
There are certainly elements of you know, heritage-based farming, the diversified, multi-speciated kind of arrangement. What's different today, there's a couple things that are different. One is we have this amazing technological infrastructure. I mean, electric fence, plastic pipe, so we can put water in a pipe. We can that gives us clean water to the animals. They don't have to drink out of a creek or a pond or something. Lightweight nursery shade cloth for sheltering that's very cheap, very expensive. The wind can blow through it and it doesn't blow it over. Bandsaw mills now allow us to essentially build tinker toy chassis and things so we can have portable infrastructure. Chippers, shredders, little diesel tractors with a front-end loader so we don't have to shovel everything. Grandpa had to shovel. This was part of the drudgery of the farm, was shoveling all the time. Now we have some cool equipment where we can be carbon-centric and really compete with chemical fertilization. So I always tell people that come, don't leave thinking. We try to take the best of Grandpa's farm and the choreography of all the multi-speciation, but we do it with modern technology, which enables us to control, shelter, move the animals with much greater environmental care than he could. I mean, like this electrified poultry netting, we can run 1,000 birds on 1,000 laying hens on pasture in this netting, which weighs 12 pounds for 150 feet, and one person can install it or remove it in 10 minutes, and it'll keep out coyotes, foxes, raccoons, and possums, keep the chickens in. So we can, every couple of days, move a flock of 1,000 birds across the pasture with shelter and safety, more hygienically, sanitarily, and ecologically friendly than you could a backyard flock of chickens on a homestead 100 years ago. It's space age with a respect to historical patterns. Mm-hmm. And when you put the two together, it's awesome. The problem is most of our technology that we've applied to agriculture takes no respect to the pigness of the pig, the choreography of this multi-speciation. And what I'm suggesting is I'm not a Luddite. I'm not opposed to technology. What we want to do is apply the appropriate technology that allows all of these plants and animals to fill their blessing niche more appropriately. That's the cool use of technology.
Well, that's an exciting vision, and I know that there are people out here that are maybe listening to this podcast that say, gee, I wish I were Joel and his family that are sitting somewhere at a desk that they're hating, or maybe they're not employed currently, and there's too many of those folks, too, right now.
Sure.
And they're saying, well, that's a wonderful dream, but I don't think I could ever get there. I've heard you before say that it's easier than you think to find somebody that might help you get started or give you some land to use to get started. Is that the case?
Yes, it is. In fact, we have a we're in a time in which a lot more people are interested in connecting with their food than they were when we started. Mm-hmm. I mean, when I started as a teenager, nobody had ever heard the word organic. Nobody had ever heard of grass-finished beef. I mean, there weren't even any farmers markets. And so the whole idea of a better food, a direct marketed, we go to the supermarket, and so today the consumer awareness has created a new market opportunity that we certainly didn't have even 20 years ago, and certainly 30 and 40 years ago when I was doing this starting. So that's a big asset. The second one is that we do have this technology. The computer microchipped electric fence energizers to allow you to control animals has come in my lifetime. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. A chainsaw to be able to cut a tree, and a bandsaw mill that's portable that you can have on your own farm and afford to buy. We didn't have that when I was growing up. That has happened in my lifetime. Yeah. And so when we look at some of this support infrastructure that we now enjoy, it's all smaller scale. Right. Kevin Kelly, the editor of Wired magazine, wrote a book. The title is "New Rules for the New Economy." He said one of the things about the information economy is that the size of everything is downsizing. The secretary's been replaced by a 4-ounce mail router. Your muscle car is replaced by a Prius that knows everything but weighs half as much. So we've changed from mass and mass and size and weight to spontaneity and light, malleability, okay? And so those kinds of infrastructural changes, nursery shade cloth for shelter, those have come literally in the last 2 to 3 decades. And those are the things that enable us as pasture-based farmers or as market gardeners, produce operators with little, walk-behind tractors and stuff. This downsizing, modulating, and mobilizing of all this infrastructure allows us to farm without owning the land. Mm-hmm. And so suddenly we can have what I call a portable farm,
right,
where our customers will move up with us, our infrastructure can move with us, and so our equity is not in land, our equity is in management, information, and customers.
Yeah.
Suddenly, now we have a completely malleable farm.
Right. Well, one thing you mentioned, the pasture-based part of your program, because livestock seem to me to get really picked on lately. I mean, people say, oh, what we all have to do is just eat a lot less meat, and mm-hmm. and you know, we've got too many animals, and yet animals are a really important part of your program. Does it sometimes seem to you that livestock are getting a bad rap?
Well, absolutely, and the problem is that that I agree with the conclusions of the data points. You know, it is a bad thing, but it doesn't have to be that way. Mm-hmm. And so the truth is that there is no animal-less ecology. All ecologies had animals, and I mean, we can go into the nuts and bolts of why animals are important, but we'll just take one, herbivores. One of the reasons herbivores are all over the planet and why there's so many of them, and because they're so beneficial for the ecology, is that the digestion of an herbivore is dark, warm, and moist, which stimulates decomposition faster than anything in a static state. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, while if we're going to grow things, we have to be able to digest things. I mean, that's the point of compost. Sure. Compost, you know, it enables us to speed up what nature would be doing very slowly. And so one of the beauties of the herbivore is that it prunes the forages that are basically physical manifestations of sunbeams, and it prunes those to restart their fast juvenile growth spurt, mm-hmm. and make sure they get decomposed rapidly to continue this life, you know, this regeneration, degeneration, you know, regeneration, this mm-hmm. cycle, to make sure that it keeps going faster. And so as soon as we take the animals and put them on pasture, put them on deep bedding, feed them GMO grains, non-irrigated from aquifers and streams, but irrigated from permaculture ponds, mm-hmm. which actually increase the hydration of the commons. When we do that, all of the negative data points change. That's the point. And so what many would consider would be negatives actually become positives when we change the production model.
When you mentioned GMO grains, were you talking about that happening to be non-GMO grains, or you're just talking about typical GMO corn that they're being?
We use non-GMO.
Oh, okay.
We use
okay.
non-GMO on our farm, and so you know.
For your organic meat?
We're not certified.
Okay.
We don't participate in the government program. You have to realize that, you know, 98% of the eggs, organic eggs in the country, are not pastured eggs. You know, they're just in confinement houses. Same with beef. You know, organic beef, most of it is not grass finished. It's feedlot finished. And so we view the organic label as being a non-comprehensive label. Right. There are a lot of subjective variables hanging around the edge of that, including worker pay, including, you know, different things that are not dealt with in the organic label. And so, you know, we direct market everything, and our customers know who we are. And,
well, you really are an open book. I mean, other people are looking to have a seal that might go on a label then that tells them something.
Right.
But they literally can read your book or read your, you know, movie or visit your farm.
Yeah, or come to the farm. Yeah.
They have any questions about how it's grown, they know that. You said one other thing that differs you from the average farmer, maybe, and that is you're not looking to the government for solutions. You were saying I've heard you say this a couple of different times, that you don't see an answer from bureaucrats.
No, I don't, because I see the government as part of the orthodoxy. You know, if anybody's seen the documentary Food Inc., one of the, I think, the most interesting part of the movie for me was the business card that flipped back and forth between the industry and the government, and the industry and the government, showing this kind of revolving door of police that come from the industry, then into the government, then they come out of the government, into the industry, and into that. And so it's a bit of an unholy alliance, you know. It's a bit of a I call it the fraternity of right. orthodoxy. And so what our message is, we want to empower customers, individuals. Mm-hmm. I mean, I buy stuff too, okay? Mm-hmm. And so what we're trying to, our message is, you don't have to wait for a label, a program, an agency, a policy change. You just need to realize that you can, today, you can participate in a healing food system by simply changing your food dollars. Simply changing, you know, how you're purchasing food and what you're doing, and there are good farmers and bad farmers. There are good models and bad models. And as you begin patronizing one over the other, you know, which dog will grow, the dog you feed, right?
Yeah, right.
As you begin patronizing one over the other, you'll also become more skillful at being able to discern which one's a good one and which one's a bad
right.
one. And you know, we live in a time right now where the average person is actually far more informed and frankly interested in the latest dysfunction of the Kardashian household than what's going to become flesh of their flesh and bone of their bones at 6 o'clock. And that needs to change. And that's the positive message.
So what do you tell a consumer if they say, okay, I'm really interested in what you're doing. I want to be a part of this. I want to be a part of encouraging this type of production. But they're not going to farm. What mm-hmm. And they're a long ways from Virginia.
Oh, okay.
What do you tell them?
Sure,
what do they do?
Sure. Well, obviously, if they're within 4 miles of 4 miles, 4 hours of Polyface, we say, well, buy from us. Okay.
Right.
But if they're beyond that, then we say, turn off your TV, mm-hmm. you know, for the year. Take 1 year, turn off the TV, and cancel your entertainment budget. Take the money and time that you would spend for 1 year on entertainment and recreation, and devote 1 year, just 1 year, that's all I'm asking, 1 year, and immerse yourself in the integrity food economy in your region.
Mm-hmm.
Every area has farms that are within 5, 6, 10 good customers of being able to quit the town job mm-hmm. and be farmers full time.
Mm-hmm.
I thousands of these, okay? All right, you be the enabler mm-hmm. that helps that farmer tip over the edge and do what he wants to do or she wants to do full time on the farm and support that, you know, mm-hmm. with your food dollar. If you will do that, the other part of that is that you will then have to begin using your kitchen to process, package, preserve, prepare things. But that is the way you save your food dollars. You see, processed food is expensive.
Mm-hmm.
And processed organic is even more expensive.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? But if you get unprocessed and then use your kitchen with all of its techno-sophisticated stuff, from time bake to, you know, slow cookers to bread makers, ice cream makers, you know, Cuisinarts, shake it, make it, blend it, right? We have this wonderful culinary technology today. I'm not talking about being barefoot and in the kitchen and you know, hearth cooking and, you know, washboards and all that. I'm talking about using the techno sophisticated stuff that we have in our kitchens and reintroducing yourself as a participant in the system. I wish I could click my fingers, snap my fingers, and say, you know what? You don't have to do anything, and it'll all be different.
Right.
But nothing in life is that way. If you want a better marriage, you don't snap your fingers and expect it to get better. If you want a better work situation, you don't snap your fingers and expect it to get better. And we can't just snap our fingers and assume that the food system will get better if we all sit around and have angst about it.
But I wonder, then, the closest thing to snapping your fingers that I can think of is that now there are stories in the supermarkets, and that probably nearly anyone around the country can go to a restaurant that's got that identifies a farm they grew from. Now, that doesn't take a lot of work, but you have to seek it out. And how do you feel about those descriptions of the farms at the stores and at the restaurants?
Absolutely. I call it the integrity food movement is on a tsunami. Right. We're on a tsunami, that's for sure. But the problem with a movement is it always attracts charlatans too. And so, this was the point of Michael Pollan's Little Red Hen story in Omnivore's Dilemma. He went to Whole Foods and saw the farmer with the little red hen and went to visit the little red hen and found out that she was one of, 20,000 in the confinement house. And so, all I'm saying is be aware. There are charlatans out there, but the more you involve yourself and don't just stop at a label or don't just stop at a clever sign, but move just like you would if you were, if you were looking for a good gynecologist or a good pediatrician for your child, you don't just stop at the diploma on the wall. Mm-hmm. You ask around and you say, is this guy, what's his record? How's he doing? Just do the same thing for your food. Yeah. That's all it takes.
It's funny. Laura Riley, the Tampa Bay Times, just did a story, and actually I did an interview with her on a podcast here. Uh-huh. And she went out and she checked, and she found an awful lot of restaurants were exaggerating.
Yes.
And they she called them on it. Mm-hmm. And I think it wasn't the bad news. The fact is that some of them were fibbing. Is that when you call them on it, they said, oh, well, we didn't get our menus updated, and we're going to do better. And so, mm-hmm. I hope that's the good news, that if people are asking questions, they find out, and it kind of shakes out the charlatans, like you're saying.
Well, they are. And the truth is that, like it or love it, technology today, here we are taping on a little, three ounce machine that, when I was a kid, you'd have a, you'd be carrying about 50 pounds of equipment. Like it or not, the technology, we are seeing the Uberization of everything now.
Yeah.
And so this accountability that you're talking about in the restaurants, there are numerous efforts now being done. The Diners United, there's Foodways in Virginia. There are numerous efforts being done to essentially AAA accountability. Mm-hmm. These restaurants, and that's a good thing. So you'll be able to go on an app and get a rating for True Blue, and they're good.
Well, I just want to swing back now one final thing. Mm-hmm. Talk about the farmers that want to get to the promised land. I mean, it's one thing to talk about all the farmers that are trying to go get started and get started doing it right, mm-hmm. but across the country, there are people who got 2,000 acres of corn and soybeans, and they're in flat ground, and they're a long ways from a city where they can do a farmer's market or CSA. I mean, what do you offer to them? I mean, what suggestions do you say if they want to head a more sustainable direction?
Yeah, that's one of the most tough questions there is, and my answer is to realize that much of the grain, I won't say most, but much of the grain grown in the U.S. goes to herbivores.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you're a corn soybean farmer, if you convert back to prairie, mm-hmm. under this intensive management that I espouse, where you're moving the animals every day, excuse me, on a fresh paddock, that when that happens, I've done the numbers over and over. One of my favorite things is to go to like Kankakee, Illinois, and have a room full of farmers and let them give me the numbers. Mm-hmm. And what happens is I can show them every time how on perennial prairie with intensive management, you can outcompete corn and beans any time of day, hands down.
Wow.
And I'm not talking about direct marketing. I'm just talking about commodity. Just you're just shifting, raising this corn to go to a feedlot,
right,
to bringing the animal to the prairie and shipping the animal off, mm-hmm. to the butcher.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. That's the only difference. And of course, the big difference then is You get rid of all your grain equipment. Mm-hmm. No tillage. The animals fertilize themselves. Mm-hmm. And you've just circumvented this incredible, you know, tillage, cropping, drying, transporting, you know, all this. Mm-hmm. And you've closed the ecological loop like the bison did on the plains, which built the soils. Now you're building soils instead of eroding soils. And you got rid of all your equipment, and all you have is a little pickup truck, you know, or a four-wheeler to get around. You know, and every time I do those things, I do side-by-side stuff like this. The farmers give me the numbers. I get done with the bottom line, and the room goes quiet. And they all kind of look at each other. And then finally, usually some like 70-year-old farmer, he starts to giggle. Mm-hmm. And he looks around and he says, "Well, boys, what are we doing?"
Yeah.
You know, and the lights go on. And they realize. So, you know, absolutely that kind of change could happen real, real fast. Now you say, well, what about all of them? You know what? I don't have an answer for all of them. Okay.
Right.
But I'll tell you this, that if you saw a significant shift in the direction that I'm talking about, what would happen is that momentum changes the whole cultural context of everything.
Right.
And then you start seeing other possibilities that aren't possible in today's context.
Right.
As the context changes, then other opportunities and possibilities exist as we change the context.
You know, it's so exciting that when you talk about all the possibilities, I mean, you make a person optimistic. Mm-hmm. And I'm just curious, of the thousands of questions that you get, what is it that you either wish had been asked of you that hasn't been, or maybe it's your favorite question that you feel is really right on the money? But you must have go through an awful lot of interviews like this, and you think and come away sometimes saying, "Well, I wish you'd asked me this." Is there any of those in your mind?
Oh yeah, I do. I do hundreds and hundreds of interviews. I just go, you know, go with the flow. I mean, this is, I've got 10 books out. You know, it's a stack. I look at it now and say, did I make up all those words? You know, I mean, over a lifetime, it's quite a pile. I mean, Wendell Berry has 57, I think. So, I'll never catch him. But yeah, there's always a different way to say or to look at the issue.
Mm-hmm.
And so I just figure that the questions are coming from the other person's context and perception. Mm-hmm. And I don't second guess. I just honor, you know, where you're coming from, and assume that you'll ask at least one or two brand new angles, and then the next person will ask a couple more, and it's quite fascinating, you know, the breadth and scope of the kinds of questions that you get asked.
Well, you know what? It's really quite a tribute to you that you are in such demand, mm-hmm. and that you do make yourself available. I know it must be tempting to stay home some of these times instead of go jump on a plane and go off somewhere and stay home, play with those grandkids,
yeah.
and enjoy
the
farm.
Yeah, that's why I don't do it for free. I mean, I do gratis things. I do gratis things, but I pick them very, very carefully.
Yeah.
Normally, I do charge an honorarium because, frankly, you know, it does take life energy,
mm-hmm.
to get on a plane and be away from your home and your family and stuff. And in fact, yes, I was asked a new question yesterday for the first time. A very interesting question. A guy asked me, how much of your self-esteem is based on, you know, speaking and, you know, traveling and, you know, being mm-hmm. the celebrity, whatever. And I said, none. I said, my esteem comes, there, nothing floats my boat more than moving a set of cows, you know, getting the chainsaw, cutting a board off the sawmill,
mm-hmm.
the smell of that sawdust. I'm a very humus guy, you know.
Yeah.
I'm a very grounded dirt, you know. I've got my calluses, and I never want to lose those, and that's why I don't travel all the time. I'm gone about a third of the time, and that's frankly enough. If I were gone anymore, my health would suffer, my calluses would disappear, and I would lose my authenticity. When I speak, people realize this is a guy who actually, you know, ran a chainsaw last week, pulled a calf the week before, you know, moved a chicken shelter, and they get that. And I never want to lose that groundedness in who I am.
Well, you know, I tell you, if people were with us here today, though, they'd be surprised you're wearing a nice pinstripe suit and you're wearing a tie. And what happened to that beat-up cowboy hat that I've seen you wear?
Well, you know, that's part of my persona. I really, when I talk to farmers, I tell farmers, men and women that are farmers, I say, folks, we need to stand toe-to-toe with Fortune 500 executives. If we want respect from culture, you know, our culture doesn't respect farmers. Mm-hmm. It puts farmers kind of in a box of like D students, you know, like you know, if you can't be an engineer, a doctor, attorney, or you know whatever,
right.
then
right.
you can go to the farm. It's okay. And I'm trying to present this Jeffersonian intellectual agrarian. That was his vision for America. This peasant intellectual, mm-hmm. you know, so I tell farmers, I say, go to farmer's market in a suit. You know, why perpetuate this sense that all farmers are a bunch of, you know, old hillbilly, you know, backwoods, you know, whatever. I tell them, read widely, read Wall Street Journal, read, you know, The New Yorker, read The Economist.
Right.
How many, not very many of them do that. In fact, most farmers I know never read. Mm-hmm. I mean, they read a magazine article from time to time, but they don't actually read books. So I chide farmers. Don't be colloquial.
Yeah.
You know, you're playing right into the hands of people that condescend to you. Instead, show yourself. Or, you know, join Toastmasters. Take some speaking lessons. Okay. And I'm so fortunate that I grew up, you know, in drama, theater. I was a debater through high school and college. And I'm very thankful for, you know, for those. I wasn't a jock, you know.
Right.
I didn't play sports. I ran my mouth, you know. And now people pay a lot of money to hear me run my mouth. but all I'm suggesting is I have this professional persona. Now, when I'm on the farm, I might be wearing a shirt, you know, that says Pedro or Stephen or
right.
Philip, you know, that I get down at the,
right.
you know, the thrift uniform
right.
store. Okay, I mean, all I need at home is rags, right? But when I go to town and I'm representing farming as a profession, I want to put on a professional look and honor this most sacred of all vocations. Because at the end of the day, Nature Conservancy, Audubon Society, Sierra Club, they're not going to protect the ecosystem.
Mm-hmm.
The ones, the front line of our ecosystem stewards is still farmers.
Boy, I think that's a good place to wrap up. And you had a lot of messages today. You had them, I think, for farmers and for consumers, for people that want to be farmers and people that want to be better consumers, too. Joel Salatin, you know, we're very fortunate to have you on the scene and having you share your wisdom and be, you know, generous in giving ideas to people that are trying to get started. So I want to thank you for being on Farm to Table Talk.
Thank you. It's been my privilege.